It's my great pleasure to welcome one of the newer members of the Australasian philosophical community, Jonathan Shafe from ANU, who is going to speak to us on truth maker commitments. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks, Mark, and thanks for having me here today. Can everyone hear me? Okay, great. So what I want to talk about today are two different accounts of ontological commitment. The old school account, Jude Quine, in which we extract ontological commitments from the quantifiers, and a new style of account that's been developed by David Armstrong, among others, on which we try and extract ontological commitment from truthmaker theory. And what I want to ultimately suggest is that both Quine and Armstrong share a common assumption that the project of metaphysics is to give the list of things that exist. And what I want to ultimately suggest is that we need a more nuanced understanding of the project of metaphysics in terms of giving us a hierarchical picture of fundamental entities and derivative entities. And when we have this more nuanced understanding, which I'll be attributing to Aristotle, actually, what we'll find is a way of understanding both the Quinean approach to commitment and the Armstrongian approach to commitment as complementary, and perhaps even both needed to tell us both what the fundamental entities are. I'll be suggesting that's what the Armstrongian account can help guide us towards, and what the total roster of entities are, both fundamental and derivative, and I'll be suggesting that's what Quinean quantifier commitments can guide us towards. I do want to note before getting any further underway, I want to note two things. First, this is my first attempt at giving a sort of serious PowerPoint presentation, so I went a little bit overboard with the slides, I fear. But second, I wanted to, the point of this slide was to call your attention to the fact that this is very much a work in progress. Quine. Sorry. Okay, so we start off with a conception, an integrated conception of the task and the method of metaphysics. I mean, this is one of the beautiful features of the Quinean approach that's won it so many adherents. So the task of metaphysics is to say what there is, to say what exists. And what exists is a list. It's a list of entities. You can think of it as a set. It's the domain of quantification, or a class, or a plurality, if you're worried about sets. What we're trying to figure out, according to Quine, is whether things like numbers, meanings, properties, possible worlds, mereological fusions, etc., whether these exist or not. That's the task, according to Quine. And according to Quine, the method, the way we're supposed to approach this, our best guide to what there is we somehow figure out what our best theory is. Then we somehow figure out what the canonical logic is, what the best logic is supposed to be. And then we somehow translate that best theory into the canonical logic. And we're allowed to do a bit of paraphrasing. We'll talk about exactly when that can happen. And what we get at the end is we get this sort of suitably regimented, you know, maybe sort of physics, suitably regimented in first order logic. And then we need to solve for the domain of quantification that's needed for the resulting formulae to be true. So what we get wind up committed to are the things that we need to posit in the quantifier domain to make this regimentation come out true. And so, for instance, I trust this is going to be fairly familiar to all of us on a Quinean approach. You know, the sort of among the central questions of metaphysics is a question, you know, do numbers exist? And if you want to know the answer to that, what you do, you take our best theory, I'm going to suppose that's physics, you suitably regiment it, I'm going to suppose that's translating into something like first-order classical logic, and you see whether the result quantifies over numbers or not. That's the game, according to Quine. Okay, problems. Many of these are fairly well known. I just want to rehearse what I think are a range of problems that kind of cluster together in the sense that they, I think, are going to point towards a common gap in the Quinean understanding of metaphysics, namely that there's no division of the domain of existence into the fundamental basic entities versus the derivative non-basic entities. So first, how exactly are we supposed to identify the best theory? you might say, well, we can look at the most empirically adequate and methodologically virtuous theory. The problem is that what we actually find, if you look, for instance, at various interpretations of quantum mechanics, just to, as an illustrative example, you find that there's various interpretations that are provably empirically equivalent. I've mentioned up here Bohmian mechanics and the many minds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which was developed by David Albert and Barry Lohr. These are provably empirically equivalent, and they're more or less methodologically, I think I tried to coin a new word, Uriah style up here, equivirtuous. Maybe there's some, they're both relatively sort of similar in ontological economy and simplicity and the like. So it doesn't seem like mere sort of empirical adequacy and methodological virtues can help decide between these theories. There's quite an obvious way to try and at least give some reason for preferring Bohmian mechanics to many minds, or perhaps the other way. On the many minds theory, minds are treated, it's a fundamentally dualistic theory in the sense that minds are treated as fundamental entities. Each observer in many minds theory is associated with continuum many indeterministically evolving minds. So you've got fundamental minds. So if you had reason for thinking that minds are not fundamental ingredients in reality, then you'd have some reason for preferring Bohmian mechanics over many minds. And that's, in fact, in the literature, the response that most people give to the Albert and Lohr construction is, we don't like the dualism. But if you had reason for thinking that mind was fundamental, then you might have some reason, not conclusive reason, but a bit of reason, for liking the many minds interpretation. So the point here is that what counts as the best theory is going to be at least partially informed by our conception of what's fundamental. The best theory is a theory of the fundamental entities. If you actually look at when Quine talks about why he likes physics, he winds up talking about limiting the true and ultimate structure of reality. So I'm suggesting that Quine was onto something there, but didn't reflect this notion of ultimate structure in his account of what metaphysics was after. We also need to identify the canonical logic. And what I'm going to suggest here, similarly, is that our view of what's fundamental and what's derivative and how things get derived winds up playing a role in debates between as to whether to go with classical logic or intuitionism or dialetheism, also to go first order versus second order. And just to review very briefly, sort of the classic discussion of classical logic versus intuitionism comes out of people like Brouwer are explicitly Kantians, and they have the view that numbers and other logical entities are mental constructions. They exist, but they are mind-dependent. They are grounded in the mind. They're not fundamental. And because they are mind-dependent, if the mind hasn't constructed a proof for P or a proof for not P, there's going to be no fact of the matter. So it's not going to be the case that P, it's not going to be the case that not P. That's how you sort of get yourself into the framework of liking an intuitionist logic. And the ontological status of numbers is actually the crucial motivating, at least among the crucial motivating intuitions that's driving Brouwer and others. If you're a Platonist about numbers and think these just exist independently of the human mind, none of this intuitionism stuff should have much bite for you. Translations. This actually came out of it in my question for Uriah, for those of you who are in the audience for the last talk. If you are just freely allowed to insert any prior phrases you like anywhere you like, you're going to get no constraints whatsoever on your theory of ontological commitment. You're going to just basically be allowed to commit to whatever you like. I mean, the whole point of the Quinean method was there's supposed to be some serious bite to the approach. So Quine himself claimed to have moved from eliminativism about numbers to realism about numbers because he thought that numbers proved to be indispensable to formally regimented mathematical physics. But in fact, if Quine had been just creative enough in his paraphrases, he could have just stuck in an according to the fiction operator in front of all the number stuff, or stuck in various adverbialist tricks. And so you can get rid of any ontological commitment you like if you don't have constraints. And suggestion, if you have a prior notion of division of entities into the fundamental and the derivative, then amongst the constraints that you can put on paraphrase strategies is that all the paraphrase goes in the direction of the fundamental. So if you've got talk about derivative entities, you're allowed to paraphrase it away, but talk about fundamental entities is not amenable to paraphrase. That's just an example of the way that a conception of fundamentality can help at least partially constrain the Quinean method. Last point up here, I could go on for probably the whole talk about these issues, but I'm just trying to get through this quickly, is that let's suppose we've got through the first three points somehow. We've got our best theory, we've got our canonical logic, and we've got our apt translations. Still, there's the matter of which domains are needed to make that translation true. And it's, in fact, provable by Lohenheim's scolem that the domain of positive integers is going to be sufficient for the truth of whatever we've gotten to up to this point. Quine himself is aware of this, and he says, so am I committed to this sort of Neo-Pythagorean ontology on which all there is are the positive integers? And he says, well, I don't have really any objection to that, save that it's not very pragmatically useful for us. So something's gone terribly wrong here, I think. I mean, on the Quinean method, if we don't have constraints on the allowable domains, to every great question in metaphysics, here is a permissible answer. There exists the positive integers. And if you thought that that was a permissible answer to every great question in metaphysics, I think somehow, somewhere, you must have misunderstood the questions. The suggestion that I want to make here, and here I'm really following David Lewis, who puts constraints on allowable properties, that they must be perfectly natural. We can extend this approach throughout to first-order individuals or whatever we're drawing our domain from, and we can say that what's allowed in the domain are the perfectly natural fundamental entities. So here's another point where we've got a problem with the Quinean method, but I'm suggesting that a notion of fundamentality can help. So those are some problems with the method, but I also want to question the task that Quine has provided us of finding out what exists. Partly because I think these are actually turn out to be, I think that's a legitimate question. Do numbers exist? I just think it's quite trivial. It's an obvious yes. And here's a proof. Here's as good a proof as you'll ever see in metaphysics. There are prime numbers. That's a mathematical truism. Whatever nominalistic intuitions are driving you against numbers aren't, to me, by my lights, oughtn't to be given nearly as much credence as this mathematical truism that there are prime numbers. And it follows from a standard adjective drop inference that there are numbers. There, proof, there are numbers. What's the problem? We can have a proof of the existence of properties. There are properties that you and I share, features we have in common. So there are properties, there are features. We can have a proof of the existence of fictional entities. Doyle created Holmes. What's created thereby comes into being. So Holmes has come into being as a creation of Doyle. Proof of the existence of proper parted relations in opposition to the mereological nihilist line that Gideon Rosen and Kian Doerr have pushed. My hands are proper parts of my body. I think that sort of deserves far greater credence than any sort of causal overdetermination argument or sort of nihilist animadversions to the contrary. So I want to suggest that most of these, the very existence questions that the Quinean took to be central to metaphysical inquiry are all trivial yes questions. There are numbers, properties, propositions, no problem. What I want to suggest instead is that the deep question isn't whether numbers exist. It's how. Are numbers fundamental entities, as Plato thought? Are they transcendent substances? Or are they somehow grounded in the concrete realm, as Aristotle argued? I think that's the real question. Or perhaps they're even grounded in mental activity, as Kant thought. I think that's the real question about numbers, isn't whether they exist, but how they do. Are they fundamental entities? Are they grounded in their concrete instances? Are they grounded in our minds? OK. Move to the Australian Sydney landscape, maybe. as I mentioned at the start, there's this rival account of ontological commitment, which has come out of Armstrong's work, in which Armstrong is in agreement with Quine about the task of metaphysics being say what there is, in the way that I just suggested maybe isn't the best view of the task of metaphysics. But he says, instead of, he offers a rival method. He says, instead of looking at the quantifier commitments, we should look at, we should find, take all the things we consider true, and we should find their truth makers. I'll be clarifying that a little bit more as we go, But just to give an example of how the method is supposed to work, take the debate over whether mereological fusions exist, take various truths, like you think, okay, you know, table is a mereological composite entity, it has a tabletop, it has legs, it probably has smaller proper parts as well. You say, well, the table is supposed to be a composite entity, take truths about the table, so here's a truth, there's a table here. Ask, does that truth have sums as its truth maker? Or I'm sort of speaking in the singular on the false presupposition that there are unique truth makers for all truths. But that's something I'm going to talk about in a bit. But that's the general method. Look to see what truth makers you need for your truths. OK, and just to, since this is sort of a fairly new view, I just want to just put a few quotes up there to show you that I didn't just make this up. There's actually people who hold this view. I'm going to suggest that this is actually a valuable view and has sort of very important work to play in a metaphysical program. So Armstrong, John Hile, Ross Cameron are among the people who've embraced this turn towards a truth-making approach to commitment. I'll leave that up for a moment while I enjoy my coffee. You don't need me to read it to you. I mean, come on. Good? Should I turn? Yeah. Okay. So let me say what are supposed to be some of the benefits of the switch from the Quinean method to the Armstrongian method. And these are the benefits according to the advocates of the Armstrongian method. I'm I don't think all of these really work out, but. So I like the first one. You avoid questions of paraphrase altogether. As I mentioned when I was mentioning some problems with the Quinean method, if you help yourself to unconstrained paraphrase, there's simply no constraints whatsoever on a theory of ontological commitment. But if you're just looking at truth makers, issues of paraphrasing never result. And there's maybe even a sort of a deeper concern to Ross Cameron. Hile voices this as well, that if ontological questions are being decided by whether or not paraphrases are available, somehow this is sort of wrongly using linguistic facts to address ontological issues. Not sure I'm willing to. I like the idea of not having to worry about paraphrase. I'm not sure there's that big a sort of general worry with, you know, appeal to whatever facts you can. Yeah, linguistic facts, sure, why not? But in any case, it's certainly a benefit to do away with questions of paraphrasing. Second, a purported advantage, and this is the one that Armstrong trumpets most of all, is this idea that the Quinean method is biased from the start against properties. Or at least the Quinean method, where the canonical logic has been picked out from the start as first order logic, where the domain is a domain of individuals, is biased against properties, because if the domain is a domain of individuals and our commitments are ultimately to the elements of the domain, we know from the start we're just going to get committed to individuals. So you might have thought that it ought to be a substantive metaphysical question whether we are ontologically committed to properties or not. And on the Quinean method, at least if we sort of just build in that we're working in first-order classical logic, it isn't a substantive metaphysical question whether we're committed to properties. It's just built in to the method from the start that there's just no way we can wind up committed to properties. And that seems biased. So Armstrong says that the great advantage of deserting Quine's procedure is so that we can treat both subject and predicate parts of the proposition with equal fairness, equal justice to all. The third sort of motivation, and I think this is the main motivation for both Cameron and Hile, is this idea that we can get these really radically minimal ontology without tears, without having to say anything crazy. So the idea is to go back, for instance, to mereological nihilism, as per the example in Hile's quote, you can say, oh, all that there aren't any mereological sums. There are only, you know, there are only atoms, only simples. And what sort of amongst the many things that have seemed wrong with that kind of nihilist approach is that it just seems obvious that there are tables, and a table isn't a mereological simple. And the idea of radical minimal ontology without tears is you can assent to the to the truth of the sentence, there are tables, and say that that sentence or proposition, it doesn't really matter for our purposes, is made true by the arrangement of simples, which is just what Heil is suggesting up here. So you can have nihilist ontology. I mean, it doesn't have to be nihilism. You can have any radically simple ontology. You can even have a Terry Horgan-style blobjectivist monism, where this is a statue is true, and the truth maker for it is a complex, perhaps adverbial state of the world. It's the world being table-ish, here-ish, or something like that. So if you wanted to be sort of radically minimal in your ontology, which as you can already have guessed from my saying that these existence questions should be trivial yes questions, I'm not so happy with myself. But in any case, this is a way of reconciling this kind of radical minimalism with the obvious linguistic truths. Okay. So now I want to talk about some problems with the Armstrongian method. And the problems really we can't really assess the Armstrongian method unless we know what account of truth-making is being used to get out the ontological commitments. And I'm going to walk through three different accounts of truth-making, the sort of standard truth necessitation account, Lewis's truth supervenience account, and an account that I like, which I'll call truth grounding, and argue that on no construal of truth makers are you going to get the results that Armstrong is hoping for. So it's good to start with a sort of probably the canonical rendition of truth making in terms of TN up here. This is a bit put in a bit simplified format. X truth makes P if and only if necessarily. If X exists, then P is true. So this is the canonical version. It's the one Armstrong himself likes. I think Cameron is pretty much on board with this one as well. So this is when the advocates of the Armstrongian method are speaking, this is, I think, clearly, this is what they have in mind. So there's two things that I want to say about TN. First, I want to just give a bunch of general complaints. I don't think that this is a viable conception of truth-making generally. Among the many problems with it are, it seems a little ontologically overblown in the following sense. You might have thought that if you wanted to get a truth maker for, this chair is red, it would be enough to believe in a chair that had the property of being red. I mean, it seems like if you believe in a chair that has the property of being red, you're not ontologically cheating when you say that there's a red chair. Yet on TN, that's not enough of a truth maker, because the chair might only be accidentally red. Maybe it could have been blue. But if it could have been blue, then it could have existed without the chair is red being true. So this is what drives Armstrong to an ontology of states of affairs that have both their individual and universal aspects essentially. But that seems overblown if you just wanted to make sure that you weren't being an ontological cheater when you said the chair is red. It seemed like a red chair was good enough for that. Moreover, the account is trivializable. If you think that propositions exist, as I was suggesting earlier, and moreover, if you think that there also exist truth and falsity features of propositions. Some propositions have the property of being true, some have the property of being false, then this is all going to come out trivializable. Among the truth makers for P is going to be the following entity, the truth of P. And what's going wrong here is that the root intuition behind truth making was this idea that truth depends on being. And you're not capturing any notion of dependence here because you don't have any asymmetric relation going on here. And that's why you can get propositions truth-making themselves according to this schema. Moreover, it gives the wrong results with necessary truths. Necessary truths turn out to have everything as their truth-maker. The wrong result with impossible entities. Impossible entities turn out to truth-make everything. Presupposes trans-world identities. So if let's say so take the chair. Suppose we think that the chair does somehow get to be the truth maker for the chair is red, but that this chair is a world-bound individual. Then since there's no other take another truth of the actual world, like this table is flat. Since the only world where this chair exists is the actual one, it's true that necessarily, if the chair exists, then the table is flat. Problems with negative existentials, I'm not going to get into that here. Whole laundry list of problems. I think Tiana sort of was a good first attempt to articulate truth-making, but has proven to be a hopeless analysis, though we can talk about that more in Q&A. What I want to suggest here is that whatever the general status of Tiana is, it's hopeless as an account of ontological commitment because it's not going to give you unique truth-makers. In particular, Tiana obeys a principle of expansivity for truth makers in the following sense. Suppose we say, that if X is a truth maker for P, then X plus any further thing will also be a truth maker for P. So let's just work with concrete individuals. So we say the chair is the truth maker for this chair is red. Then it's going to follow that the merely logical sum of the chair and the table will also do the trick and truth make this chair is red. And that's going to mean that ultimately, it's going to mean that every truth is going to have a whole range of truth makers up to and including the entire universe, which is the sum of all things. But if the ontological commitments are to the truth makers, then, or to all of the truth makers, then every truth is going to be committed to the existence of every single entity in the whole world. So you might have thought that the proposition Jonathan exists gets you committed to Jonathan, but doesn't get you committed to Mark, for instance. It seems like sort of a sort of truism about how ontological commitment is supposed to work. But under TN and given expansivity, among the truth makers for Jonathan, if Jonathan can serve as a truth maker for Jonathan exists, then Jonathan plus Mark can equally serve as a truth maker for Jonathan exists. So among the truth makers we get committed to is Jonathan plus Mark. And so now we've gotten Mark, which is a good thing. But not a result we're supposed to get directly out of truth maker theory for Jonathan exists. Okay. So this a natural thought here, by the way, is you might think, we want to not just allow any old truth maker to be what we're committed to, but only the minimal truth maker. Whereas the minimal truth maker is sort of the Armstrong puts it, it's the smallest of all the truth makers. It's you sort of think of running expansivity backwards. And the problem with this, and this is a point that Armstrong himself is aware of, due to Greg Restall has a nice example. There's a bunch of other examples where there are truths that don't have minimal truth makers. Restall's example is the truth. There are infinitely many electrons. So imagine that we have all the electrons, you know, E1, E2, E3, dot, dot, dot. That's a truth maker for their infinitely many electrons, as is E2, E4, E6, E8, dot, 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 as is E4, E8, E12, dot, dot, dot. We can sort of keep paring that down, and we'll still get enough for their infinitely many electrons. Another example, imagine that we have a homogeneously pink cube of gunk. So gunk is matter, every part of which has proper parts. Consider the truth, something is pink. Since the cube of gunk has no minimal parts, there's no minimal pink bit. There'll be no minimal truth maker for something as pink. But clearly, there are infinitely many electrons is ontologically committal. You've got to have a lot of electrons. There's something pink is ontologically committal as well. You've got to have some pink stuff in the world. So if we only look to minimal truth makers now we've lost ontological commitment for these clearly committal sentences like there are infinitely many electrons. OK, so a different approach. This is due to Lewis. To truth making, it's truth supervenience. No two worlds differ over truth without also differing over being. And Lewis says that differences in being can boil down to either differences in census, in how many things there are, or differences in features, in how these things are. There's some general problems with TS as an account of truth making. It's trivializable if you think that propositions are things and that they have truth and falsity features. Gives the wrong results with necessary truths and falsehoods because you don't have any two worlds that differ over necessary truth and falsehood. So it just imposes no constraints whatsoever with respect to those. And what I think is worst of all, I mean, keep in mind that the root intuition that we're trying to capture with truth maker theory is this idea that truth depends on being. But as is fairly well known now, I think, in the literature, supervenience just doesn't capture a notion of dependency. Dependency is an irreflexive, asymmetric notion. Supervenience is reflexive, and it's not asymmetric. just has the wrong logical features to capture the notion of dependency. And a way to see this is that the relation in TS is actually a perfectly symmetric relation of supervenience. This is a point that actually Aristotle first made when he was introducing the notion of ontological priority. So it's true that no two worlds can differ over truth without also differing over being, but it's equally true that no two worlds can differ over being without also differing over truth. And when Aristotle actually first introduces this point, he says that the implication from the existence of a man to the sentence, the man exists, is reciprocal, runs in both directions. If the man exists, if the sentence is true, and if the sentence is true, the man's got to exist. But he says, clearly here, there's an asymmetry. The sentence is true because of the guy, and not the other way around. And that's gone missing on the supervenience approach to trying to understand dependency. At any rate, never mind the general complaints that I've just voiced against truth supervenience. It's just the wrong thing for the Armstrongian. It just gives you no commitments at all. Why? Because it doesn't say X truth makes P if and only if and gives you an X that's the truth maker. It's just a global supervenience claim. It just tells you how worlds have to be. So whatever you think of TS, it just can't be combined with Armstrongian method for entity for entity commitments. Okay, last account, and this is the one that I like, and I think of this as really sort of an attempt at a direct articulation of the intuition that truth depends on being, where the idea is I'm just going to help myself to this relation of grounding or ontological dependence. I actually think this is, I actually want to treat this as a metaphysical primitive, but that's not needed for the account that I'm giving. If you think there can be an analysis of the notion of grounding, feel free to plug it in. Just make sure that you give that your account makes grounding into the, or dependency, into the irreflexive and asymmetric relation that it needs to be. So don't go supervenience. So the idea is that we want to find the ultimate fundamental grounds for the truth of a proposition. And so the idea here is that the reason why truth depends on being is because we see that truth and falsity features of propositions are not fundamental features of reality. If we take, for instance, fundamental physics to be guiding us towards the fundamental features of reality, we don't find fundamental physics speaking of the truth and falsity features of propositions. It's just not in there. And that's some indication that truth and falsity features for propositions in this sort of abstract entities, this is not fundamental. And there's a general point that what isn't fundamental must be grounded in what is fundamental. So given that truth isn't fundamental, it follows that it must be grounded in what is fundamental. And TG is just an attempt to say that to assimilate what it is to be a truth maker with what it is to be the fundamental ground that makes something true. And I've got some quotes from Armstrong and Rodriguez Pereira that I'll leave for you to read on here, where I think even though neither of them gives a TG as an account, they are reporting the intuition that TG pretty literally is a rendition of. And I think it's TG is basically, as I was saying, the literal rendition of truth depends on being. So, and here's where I'm going with this. TG is, I think, so this is the kind of truth making that I like. Maybe you'll have some objections. I'm happy to talk more about the viability of TG as an account of truth making, but I'm going to go thumbs up on TG here. And what TG is just committing us to, the only X's that it allows are X's that are ultimate grounds, fundamental entities. So this gives you a commitment to fundamental entities. It doesn't give you commitment to all the entities there are, because not every entity is a fundamental entity. There are tables. I take that to be beyond serious doubt, I take that to be beyond serious doubt. There are tables. Surely tables are not fundamental entities. So TG commitments will give us commitments to whatever particles, or I think more seriously, fundamental fields that permeate space-time are the ultimate grounds for the existence of tables, won't give you a commitment to the tables themselves. So where I'm going with this, and this will come out momentarily, is that the TG commitments are really valuable in teaching us, getting us to something, not to what there is, but to what there is fundamentally. Neo-Aristotelian framework. So what I want to suggest, and this is sort of hopefully foreshadowed a lot of this already, is that I think there was a wrong turn that sort of comes out of the Quine-Carnap debate, this focus on existence, and that is perpetuated in the Armstrongian approach, and that really is a real divergence from the entire thread of historical metaphysics. I mean, and I think in this sense that the sort of positivist revolution, a lot of the sort of traditional concepts that are needed for metaphysics were lost for a few generations, and we're still in the process of trying to recover these crucial concepts. And the place to look, of course, the locus classicus is Aristotle's metaphysics. So if you look at Aristotle's metaphysics, you will find virtually no existence questions. I mean, if you thought that metaphysics was about existence questions and you read the Aristotle's metaphysics, you will be confused. There's a few places, I mean, there's lots of reasons why you might be confused by Aristotle. It's a very confusing text, but even more confused. There's just a couple of places where Aristotle touches on existence questions. There's a place in Metaphysics Mu where he considers the question of whether numbers exist. And his answer is a one-sentence brief and dismissive, of course. He says, you know, numbers exist, and they have the character ascribed to them by mathematicians. That's all he says about the existence of numbers. And that's virtually the only existence questions he considers in the whole text. What he goes on and on about is how they exist. Are they substances, as Plato thought? Or are they derivative entities grounded in the concrete realm, as Aristotle himself is defending? And in general, Aristotle characterizes the whole discipline of metaphysics not as the study of what there is, but as the study of substances, which for him are fundamental entities, and what depends on them. So there's a little quote up there. And so what we need to do, if we're going to return to this kind of Aristotelian conception of metaphysics that I've been sort of hinting at all along and all this talk about fundamentality that I've engaged in, is we're going to need to figure out not just this sort of unstructured list of existence, but this hierarchically structured thing where the existence are divide into the fundamental ones and the derivative ones. So we're going to need to figure out not just the total list, but how to divide the list into fundamental versus derivative. And what I'm going to be suggesting is that the Quinean and the Armstrongian approaches might just be just what we needed. So abundant quantifier commitments. What exists? Everything. Numbers, properties, propositions, possible worlds, fusions, fictional characters. This was what I was arguing for earlier when I was saying we should be very permissive. There's no problem with recognizing, there's actually sort of as close to a knockdown argument as you get in metaphysics for the existence of many of these entities. But the thing that I want to add is, don't be alarmed. Don't panic. Don't think that we've sort of trivialized metaphysics in saying, of course, numbers exist, because this permissivism only concerns the shallow question of what's on the total list of existence. The deep question isn't whether numbers exist, but how they do. And we can be extremely restrictive. We ought to be extremely restrictive about the fundamental sparse grounds of being. And we're going to need to tell a detailed story. We're either going to need to say that numbers are fundamental substances. There's lots of problems with going that way. Or we're going to need to be able to tell a story about how it is that numbers can be grounded in the concrete realm. And here, we can, for instance, appeal to a lot of the programs that have been trotted out under a limitativist banner. So, for instance, Hartree Field has a whole sort of brilliant, detailed, elaborate construction for how you can get numerical structure out of space-time points and betweenness and congruence relations over the space-time points. So, I'm just giving you an illustration of the way that you can try and claim numbers to be derivative entities. If you have, let's say, if you're a space-time substantivalist, so you have space-time points as fundamental, and you have these betweenness and congruence relations, never mind how you've gotten to those, then you can plug in the field construction, no longer understood in an eliminativist way, but rather understood as the grounding story for how it is that space-time with certain properties grounds numbers. And it's a hard issue. So that doesn't, we're not, nothing's become, that isn't becoming trivial. So what I want to suggest, just back to this, is that the quantifier commitments, what Quine was on about, should be taken without paraphrase to be a range of commitments to this vast list of entities. Whereas the sparse commitments, I'm suggesting, can be identified with the truth-maker commitments understood via TG. So what's fundamental of truth-makers? And perhaps these are just point particles, or I think serious physics would take it to be the space-time manifold and certain fundamental fields smeared across the manifold. So the idea is that this notion of truth-maker commitments ought to converge with other diagnostics for fundamental entities, like being posited by fundamental physics, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea is that we can use this conception of truth-maker commitments as yet another converging line towards trying to say what is fundamental. And wrapping up, good on time. So I'm suggesting that this neo-Aristotelian framework with this multiple levels of fundamental and derivative gives us the best picture of metaphysics and the best approach to ontological commitment, where we get two layers of commitment. We have commitment to fundamental entities, what I have down here at the sparse ground of primary entities, and we have this also this sort of total commitment to this abundant superstructure of secondary entities in addition to the sparse grounds of being. And the sort of, the conciliatory suggestion is that the neo-Armstrongian can embrace both the Quinean and the Armstrongian approaches as telling her how to answer both of her commitment questions. Thank you. I think he has arguments against Democritus.
Far better candidates for fundamentality.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just wondering why, what do you think is going on with Aristotle? He's not using fundamental anything like the way you are. He's using fundamental as most easily recognizable as talked about.
Aristotle has a notion of priority in nature. What I think is going on in Aristotle is that Aristotle actually, if you go to the categories, he has about 7 or 8 different criteria for being a substance. Included amongst the criteria for being a substance is being basic in the priority in nature ordering. But also included among the criteria for being a substance is being the subject but never the predicate. Also included in the criteria for being a substance is being able to survive intrinsic change. Aristotle builds in lots of different criteria, and that's going to prevent him from accepting certain pictures of what substances might be like. When I say I'm sort of a neo-Aristotelian framework, I don't mean that I'm sort of buying into every single bit of the Aristotelian framework. In particular, I'm not buying into a lot of the criteria that Aristotle provides for substances. I am, however, identifying, picking one of the criteria, fundamental entity, being basic and the priority in nature ordering, which a lot of Aristotle scholars like Wedin calls it sort of the grand finale of the categories, is this idea that substances are the things on which all else depends. And so I'm sort of highlighting that feature of Aristotle's talk about substances and just talking about that. Yes.
Beyond your notion.
That's absolutely right. And so one of the things that I'm sort of trying to do, if we go back through Aristotle's list, which I'm not going to now, I would actually argue that they pretty much all pull apart. So it's sort of a Aristotle has the very substantive metaphysical thesis that the following list of seven criteria are all going to converge on the same sorts of objects. And in particular, these objects are going to be like individual organisms. And I just don't think that works out, though that's a controversial claim, obviously. But in any case, I'm going to say let's just focus on this one criteria. That's fundamentality.
You're right. There's some stuff you want to shed in the traditional way of doing metaphysics. I worry that maybe we'll lose more than just what we want. I'm worried that in the traditional way we're thinking about metaphysics, you take the criterion for ontological commitment, notification, truth making, or something, and you crank it up, and it spits out what the entities you should be committed to. When we use TG, we cannot quite do that because we have to assume already what's fundamental. It's just cranking the truth making machinery doesn't tell you which thing is fundamental. For example, when you have a state of affairs like chair is red, there are two views you could have about what's fundamental here and what's not. And you know, the truth maker, I want to say, might be very different, but the truth making machinery will not be able by itself to distinguish. So the two situations that I have, two views that I have in mind is, one view is that the state of affair of the chair being red is a composite entity made up in some way from the chair and the redness and maybe an instantiation relation between them. And state of affairs is composite, and the incomposite symbols are maybe the chair and redness. You have the other view where the state of affair is a simple incomposite entity, and chairs are just collections, compositions in some sense of chairy state of affairs, and redness is a collection. And now, which in the first view, the particulars and properties are the fundamental entities. In the second view, states of affairs are the fundamental entities. Mm-hmm.
That's not obvious. I mean, are you assuming that because the state of affairs is composite, it couldn't be fundamental? Is that, are you assuming that?
Yes.
We can talk about either.
That is what I had in mind. If what's fundamental is the thing that's incomposite.
Simple.
So I think, yes, I was working. Maybe you want to deny that, but
I'm happy to talk about it, to grant the assumption further.
So you have two ontologies here about what's fundamental. And what will TG tell you? TG cannot. TG has to suppose already which one is the fundamental one, which is, it cannot tell you which one is the fundamental state of affairs or the chairs of the properties.
I'm not sure. There are some parts that I'm not fully understanding. So I'm thinking that what TG. So you can imagine that when you sort of run the TG machinery, what it spits out are a list of individuals and a list of properties, or that when you run the machinery, what it spits out is a list of states of affairs. Whatever it spits out, that's identified with what's fundamental. So if there is a fact of the matter about what it spits out, then that's telling you what's fundamental. You're worried that I didn't yet give you enough information to tell you which ontological category, whether when you crank up the TG machinery, it was going to spit out individuals and properties or going to spit out states of affairs. And to do that, I need to tell you more about features of fundamentality.
So it sounds to me like
I'm going to claim it's going to spit out thick particulars, which are like states of affairs, but I haven't given you enough to say why I think that.
It sounds to me like you have to already settle that issue, and then it's then that will settle what the TG machinery spits up. It's not like in the traditional way, the way Quine thought about it. Yeah. You don't settle anything prior to cranking your machine. You're cranking your machine, and what it spits up, that settles the question what exists. That kind of role is not going to be played by TG. It's not like you have no questions, nothing settled about which fundamental entities there are, and you crank your machine, and the machine tells you, gives you the answer.
That's right. That's right.
It's, that bit will be lost. Maybe you're happy with it.
That bit will be lost by if TG is deployed alone as a way to try and discover the fundamental entities. I was rather trying to suggest that TG is one of many converging lines on the fundamental entities. So I was suggesting fundamental physics as a guide to the fundamental entities, and I'd also suggest, and we can go into more detail if you want, though maybe we don't need to for now, that there's other metaphysical constraints on being a fundamental entity. Let me just sketch one, a very controversial one, which is that the derivation relations are all relations of abstraction, by which I mean the abstraction in the classical sense of aspectual subtraction. So the idea is that the fundamental entities are going to have to be, the full roster of fundamental entities is going to have to be loaded up with enough sort of concrete information that everything that you want to count as derivative is going to have to be an abstract aspect of it. And that's going to favor something like states of affairs. Because keep in mind the way states of affairs or thick particulars are supposed to work is that individuals and properties are supposed to be abstractions out of these things. And that, so if you have this general picture that grounding relations are abstraction relations, then that's going to give you further guidance as to how to make this choice. And that goes, you're absolutely right that goes beyond TG. TG is supposed to, maybe I didn't say this clearly enough, it wasn't supposed to be sort of the one and only guide that we have to the fundamental entities, but merely part of how we try and pick them out. Yes, I am.
Okay, right. This is like intuitively, a lot of those sort of classic metaphysical questions, it looks like you get sort of, as Ed Dry was suggesting, an equivalent potential truth maker, but then this is where you bring in the additional.
I'm assuming that there is an ontological fact of the matter, and that's obviously
and
that's a.
Both machinery of physics and some other ontological principles in order to sort of solidify which is the unique ultimate ground.
Yeah, that's the picture. There are tables.
Would you say the more important question, though, is what is fundamental? So I'm worried that you might be smuggling in a kind of paraphrasing anyway, because you ultimately want to know what is it that makes it true that there are tables, or whichever, whatever.
That's
say,
among the things that I want to know. It's,
by
It's not paraphrasing in the sense that I was using paraphrasing and in the sense in which people are objecting to the Quinean use of paraphrase. So remember when Cameron objects to Quinean use of paraphrase, he says serious ontological questions are being decided by linguistic issues. So I understand paraphrase, and the way I was understanding Quine as well, maybe I'm wrong, is that it was a matter of something like meaning equivalence. It's tricky with Quine because he's a meaning nihilist, but it's something like preserving the meaning. If by paraphrase you mean something like giving an ontological account, which I take is not a so you were then associating with conceptual analysis, and I'd want to separate those as well. Conceptual, I think concepts are things in our mind, and a conceptual analysis is something like an attempt at defining one concept in our mind by other concepts in our mind. Whereas an ontological account is not about concepts in our mind, but about things in the world, and it's about how things in the world depend on each other. If all you mean by paraphrase now is say how things in the world depend on each other, then yeah, that's what I'm saying we should be talking about. Well, it's not I mean, you're calling it paraphrase, but it's not.
Ontological analysis. Why should we avoid one, and then what makes it better to give the one kind of analysis rather than the other?
Well, right, good. So that was when I was going on and one of the early slides about problems with the Quinean method. I was suggesting that the method just is going to face trouble at every stage unless we come to it with. The idea that the domain of entities is already divided into the fundamental versus the derivative. So the idea is that we need this notion in order to get, we need this notion of ontological dependence, which I don't think of it, it's not a paraphrase at all, it's just an ontological, it's a grounding story, to get any of the Quinean machinery rolling. So it's the idea is it's unavoidable. Okay, so let me say how I'm thinking of it, but then I'll generalize from that a bit. The way I think of these notions, I think this notion of ontological dependence or grounding is not only a primitive notion, but it's the or priority in nature, to use Aristotle's term, but it's the primitive structure and concept of metaphysics. What it is then to be fundamental can be defined as X is fundamental if and only if there does not exist a Y such that Y grounds X. So a fundamental entity is one that isn't grounded in anything else. So you can just like it's sort of like with the mereological concepts, you can start with, say, proper parthood and define up a whole family of concepts. You can start with grounding and define up a whole family of concepts, the fundamental entities, the derivative entities, interdependence. I'll spare you. So but you can do this. That said, you needn't take this notion of grounding as primitive. Maybe there's some analysis of it that could be given, though I'm skeptical. Rather, if you say that I don't understand this notion of grounding, then I would come back to you with sort of classical examples like the Euthyphro dilemma. So in the Euthyphro dilemma, Plato has Socrates ask, is something holy because it's beloved by the gods, or beloved by the gods because it's holy? We teach this to our undergraduates, or at least before I came to ANU, I used to. They got it, or at least they seem to nod at the right times. I mean, I think we understand the Euthyphro dilemma, and that's an understand and that, and that's to understand the Euthyphro dilemma is to understand this idea of ontological dependence in action. So I say, if you understand the Euthyphro dilemma, you understand ontological dependence. If you understand ontological dependence, I can define up everything else like being a fundamental entity, in such terms. This is the dispute between the pluralist and the monist, classically conceived. The pluralist possibility that maybe that sort of concrete entities are all grounded in atoms, abstract entities are all grounded ultimately in like maybe the empty set or something like that, and there's no sort of further ground in which, so with this sort of neo-Aristotelian framework is the sort of metaphysical framework is neutral on that. My own view is I sort of would want to follow Aristotle a bit further and say that the abstract entities have to be grounded in the concrete realm, but that's a huge, further commitment that you don't have to sign up for to like this picture.
I have a question for you, and since there are no other, I'm not abusing my role as chair. There are no other. I haven't missed anyone.
No. Okay. So one thing I was sort of puzzled about, you went through the Quinean story and raised the objections. That all seemed right. And then when you said, now we combine the two pictures, there's the Quinean story, which gives us the kind of the long list, as it were, and then we get the fundamentals from the Armstrong-style approach. But the long list looked nothing like the kind of list that Quine would sign up for. So I was wondering what sense... it seemed much more like a kind of naive sort of Armstrong view, for getting the long list. There's some property which you and I share, therefore there are properties. That sounds much more like a kind of that the properties are the kind of truth maker for the sentence that you and I share something, rather than for Quine it's got to be part of the best overall theory of the world. And it's not clear that you and I share a property is the sort of thing that plays that kind of role in the overall. So anyway, just for more information about that long list seemed to depend on something other than the Quinean approach, as it were. I thought the Quinean approach would be much more
good.
That
so the sense in which I was trying to assimilate it to the Quinean approach, though it doesn't draw on, you're right that there's some divergence, from Quine as well, is I was saying that this comes through us through quantifier commitment. So I was putting all of these in terms of quantified sentences. So there are prime numbers, therefore there are numbers. So the idea, and the idea is that if we don't engage in any paraphrase, and that was sort of part of the point is, and that this is one of the places in which I'm going to diverge from Quine now, don't do any of the paraphrasing. So then there are numbers just because it's going to look like something like, backwards EX, NX, or whatever. There's X, X is a number. And this is going to commit us to the numbers. So the idea was that it was supposed to be Quinean in the sense that we were getting our commitment from seeing what we were quantifying over. But not fully Quinean in the sense that I wasn't making any attempt to paraphrase away. And so Quine will take these property sentences and try and paraphrase them away.
If the first got to make it into the sort of the short list by making it into the best theories, and then even the stuff that makes it into the best theory, that's where the paraphrases come in, at least my understanding of Quine.
Yeah.
You take all the stuff that's in the best theories, and then you find there are some embarrassments like incompressible fluids.
Right.
So you do a bit of paraphrasing there, but things like Sherlock Holmes
Snipper.
Lived in London. Well, that just doesn't make the cut initially because it doesn't even get into their scientific theory. So I wouldn't call that paraphrasing. I think that a lot of the stuff just doesn't make the cut to start with.
This is a part that I'm actually a bit confused about with in terms of reading Quine, and maybe you can help me understand Quine. Sometimes it seems to me as if Quine is talking about our best theories being only sort of fundamental physics. And I was actually mentioning that myself when I was saying that we needed this account of fundamentality to get at the best theory. But other times, Quine seems to be talking about the sort of commitments of total theory. And total theory isn't just physics. So when we're talking about total theory, we're talking about not just physics, not just biology, but also our literary theory as well, I take it. So maybe you can help me understand Quine a bit better. But let me just say, in terms of the way I'm trying to assimilate something from the Quinean approach into this neo-Aristotelian picture, what we want are the quantifier commitments of total theory unparaphrased. That was what I was trying to use. And maybe that's quite a divergence from Quine already. That
sort of makes sense in my comment then about being looking more like Armstrong, because then total theory then is kind of like something like all of the things that we take to be true.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean by that.
Okay.
But then I'm not saying... But the way in which it still has a Quinean flavor to it, I think, and you know, if it doesn't, okay, maybe I should distance myself more from Quine. But I think the way that it still had a Quinean flavor is I was taking the commitments just from looking at what we were quantifying over, and I wasn't asking what the truth maker was for there is a table. I was just saying that's just existential quantification over a table, and that's enough for tables and.
The route from Armstrongianism to states of affairs goes through TM. So it's the truth maker, the truth necessitation account of truth making that's Armstrong's argument for needing states of affairs. So if you remember when I was giving the example of why the chair isn't a truth maker enough for the chair is red given TM, because it could be merely accidentally red. And that's why he needed something that was essentially whose existence required not just a chair, but a red chair. You know, it was essentially both a chair, chairish, and essentially reddish at the same time. And that's how Armstrong gets to states of affairs. So if you drop TN and you move to something like TG, and this is actually somewhat connected to Uriah's question. Actually, on a TN account of truth making, you do settle the ontological category of the fundamental entities. As states of affairs, just as Armstrong says. But on TG, you actually don't directly settle the ontological category of the fundamental entities, and it's a further question, and we need further constraints. Now, it so happens that I do like a kind of states of affairs or thick particular picture. And if that gets us to structuralism, then I'm really pleased. But I don't know enough to see offhand how that goes.
Individuals or objects, and that this alternative approach has got to get us away from that focus, onto relations and properties, and that's got to be good for a philosophy of maths, for independent reasons. There are all these puzzles in philosophy of maths that Benacerraf wrote, put forward that arise because of this focus on objects, individuals.
Sounds good to me. You can tell me more about these.
I just want to sort of defend the Quinean line here, because I noticed that the Armstrong objection to Quine as being biased against properties went by without comment, and when it's clearly false. And this is a common mistake. You find this all over the place, and particularly in literature on the Skolem theorem, you find this mistake being made as well. Look, the fact of the matter is, there's no bias in regimenting yourself to a first-order language against properties, right? Your thinking that there is because you are committing the mistake of thinking that the objects of the domain are objects like us and not properties themselves. Right? Remember, you can have in your domain objects which are themselves properties. Right? And then you can have a relation between those sorts of objects and particulars, say the having relation. There's nothing in the restriction to a first order language that restricts you being able to quantify over properties. This mistake of Armstrong's just, you know, needs to be pointed out. And remember also that there's no restriction to first order language to avoiding modality. Right? Lewis's extensional theory, if you like it, is an extensional approach to first order approach to modal idioms in our natural language. So I reckon this mistake, and it is clearly a mistake, needs to be jumped on because we don't want to go too quickly between the first order regimented language and our ordinary language and think that just because we would treat properties as having some relation to predicates, that the only way we could have in our formal language of representing properties is to quantify at the second order level. This is just not so.
I don't understand what you mean by first order. I know what I mean by first order because it marks a distinction between individuals in my first order domain and properties in my second order domain. I don't know what you mean by first order if you think that if you're just using it freely and saying, oh, any entity can be in my first order domain. Now I'm wondering, what is that? Now you've lost me.
Okay, then there's a distinction we can make between a language where we have which has objects, so it has terms that get assigned an object in the domain, and then there's other terms that get subsets of that domain. That will be a second order language. The one where you just assign an object is a first order language. Right? The way we formally define a distinction between first and second order languages is by how they relate to the domain. So, for instance,
I'm aware of the formalities, but the formalities serve a purpose. They're supposed to mark an ontological distinction. Otherwise, I don't understand what they're doing. I mean,
they mark a formal distinction, but now there's a bit of metaphysics going on when you assume that a first order language must therefore answer the question, are there properties, by saying no, because we couldn't have such an object in the domain. That's just simply not true.
A couple of fingers on this, you're right, and Keith. You're right.
So this is the same thing, and I think it's maybe very incidental to the purposes of your talk, but maybe you can just enlighten me on one thing that I'm not clear, but how this idea that the Armstrong way and the Quine way are supposed to spit out different results. I guess the idea is that in Quine, you have a subject predicate sentence, only the term in the subject position is ontologically committing, whereas in Armstrong, also the term in the predicate position is ontologically committing. For some reason, I guess the copyright supposed not to be, or maybe it is, I'm not sure. I'm thinking, whenever you have a whole sentence, like the chair is red, you can produce nominals from it, which then can be plugged into the subject position. So you'll have the perfect nominal, the chair's redness, and the imperfect nominal, the chair's being red. Both of these can function in the subject term, and then you'll get commitment to the same things. Using Quine, you'll get commitment to the same things that you wanted to get committed to using Armstrong. And again, it sounds to me like you'll have to settle in advance. So that already is objectionable.
You'll get commitment, assuming that you don't paraphrase, you'll get commitment to the chairs being red.
Mm-hmm.
But you still haven't gotten redness out of that yet.
I see, so you get the state of affairs.
Assuming you don't paraphrase, you've got the state of affairs.
Yeah. What about the
but that, you haven't got the universal.
So I think of the imperfect nominal, the chair's being red, as picking out the state of affairs. But the perfect nominal, the chair's redness, as picking out a trope or a particularized property. Yeah. And so if you think of it that way, you will get properties but particularized, not universal properties. But maybe you're right, you still haven't gotten the universal redness from this manipulation. So they do speak different.
Keith.
Well, I want to go back to Michaelis's point about the extent to which the Quinean structure is or is not prejudiced against problems. Formally, Michaelis is right, because it depends on the vocabulary that's available. If the vocabulary, which goes into the predicate position, is all the things that describe problems, then of course it would be problems which are in the domain, none of which the individual variables range. But it's not unfair to say that Quine's system is biased against properties, his own whole nominalism, because he's so reluctant to have a rich vocabulary of descriptors for properties in the first order senses, which he qualified senses, which he allows. So that although formally there's no anti-property structure in Quine, in Quine's theory of commitment, he actually managed to present a philosophy which was avoiding commitment to properties by the restrictions which he put on the vocabularies and the predicates.
Don't deny me that. I think that's exactly right. But it's not the formal structure that's doing it.
Or it's the formal structure interpreted. It's an understanding of what it is to be a first-order individual.
The last bit I disagree with.
Okay. We can continue.
Yeah.
Okay. And Jonathan, maybe a trivial point. But it has to do with the distinction between states of affairs and fundamental entities. History tells us that democracies thought atoms were fundamental, and then later it turns out that they were states of affairs, which are in fact themselves quite complex, and are compounds of large numbers of bits and so on. So there's always has to be this, as far as we know, qualifier, where things are fundamental until we discover they're not. I don't think that contradicts anything you've said. It just means that your project is never complete. You never know that something is truly fundamental, because it may turn out that at some level of detail it goes a bit further. And so fundamentality is not itself an establishable or a readily establishable point, I don't think.
There's a question of whether physics, for instance, will ever be complete, and a further question of whether, even if it happens to be complete, we can ever know it to be complete, this sort of Kantian question as to whether. If we could achieve a complete physics and know it to be complete, then I think we'd have pretty good grounds for thinking that, yeah, we're done.
I don't think it says anything against what you said. Highlights the point that it's not entirely unproblematic.
I absolutely agree. This is somewhat connected to the point that Amy was raising about the uniqueness assumption, which is I'm building in a kind of a metaphysical realism with respect to the fundamental. And as typically sort of, not always, but typically goes along with such a realism, there's always a bit of skepticism or a bit of fallibilism with respect to our grasp of this objective fact. So yeah, we could be totally wrong.
Okay, well, before we thank Jonathan, a couple of announcements. One is, if you haven't seen Hugh or Luca about dinner, Hugh. If you haven't seen Hugh about getting your name on the dinner list tonight, do so shortly. And for lunch, I think we're just making our own way, and we'll be back here at 2:30. I won't give you instructions. If you can't find food in King's Cross, then you've got big problems. But we'll see you back here at 2:30. And thanks to Jonathan for a very stimulating talk.